You're listening to First Wall Rebate. With me, as always, are Trevor Dodge and Sean Ryder.
How you doing?
Good evening.
And joining us today for a very special episode is the news director at Gamasutra and columnist at Kotaku. In addition to being the brain behind Sexy Video Game Land, Lee Alexander, who we've been very excited to speak with for a while now. So, Lee, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, hi. It's nice to be here. That was so sweet.
Welcome.
Definitely. I know we're all... big fans of your work, and we definitely appreciate some of the kind of contemplative nature you try to bring to a medium that's often, you know, too fast-paced for its own good, in my opinion, maybe.
Well, thank you very much. That's nice of you to say. I appreciate that.
Definitely. And I think, I've been reading back over some of your recent posts today, kind of getting ready for this show, and I feel like particularly the most recent post at Sexy Video Game Land, anyway, as far as I'm aware, unless you posted today, is...
Nope, I did not.
Is...
What's wrong with you? Get on it already.
Yeah, well, you just wrote up this really interesting post about the kind of filmic nature of the medium and everything. I wonder if you might want to maybe give us a little bit of a brief summary of that. It might give us a jumping off point for this conversation.
Oh man, I got to talk about work. I thought we were just going to drink. one of the things that I've observed lately in my gameplay habits is that I don't feel the same way about games in any way that I did when I was young. Now, of course, part of that is chalk it up to, you know, nostalgia. When you're young, your life is completely different. Now that it's my job, I'm not going to have the same relationship with games. But one of the things that I've really been noticing is that I've had a hard time really getting immersed the way that I used to back in the day, because everything is in such short gameplay doses, and it's supposed to be very jump in and jump out, and I'm finding myself becoming more passive as a player. So I was just kind of lately thinking about, like, back when, like, the PS1/2 era was in its heyday, and we had, like, these games that played like real epics, and then so much of what made those games what they are not done anymore in design. They're considered, you know, don't do cutscenes, don't do, you know, steep difficulty, don't do single player, you know, don't do a linear story, you know, so there's a lot of stuff that is different that I kind of miss.
You know, I was listening, Lee, this is Trevor, and I was listening to a podcast just earlier today, the Gamers with Jobs podcast, and they were talking about some really interesting newer developments, and they had one of the Mucky Mucks from PopCap. I'm just choking down my own drink here for a second. And what they were talking about was this really interesting conveyance of the, how do I say this and paraphrase it exactly, the rise of so-called casual games, but this problem that arises within longer games where you'll play it for a while, maybe an hour or so, and then you'll put it down for a couple of weeks, and then you'll come back to it, and you're a different person, you're a different player.
There's a completely very steep barrier to return. Like there are some games that if you put them down, you can't go back to them.
Yeah, and for us three, we're kind of we've got more sort of writerly inclinations, and something that we've talked about on our podcast before is sort of entry into like short fiction, and where someone like Edgar Allan Poe's ideas of what a short story should be, I think, are really applicable to the gameplay experience, where he theorizes that, you know, that the optimal fictional experience should happen in one sitting, and he calls the novel like this imperfect thing because you can't control the reader from one sitting to the next. And as I was listening to that podcast today, I couldn't help but think about your post on Sexy Video Game Land as well, and I was wondering if that's something that's also So not necessarily Poe and his theories specifically, but that sort of movement from one sitting to another as we become different players from sitting to sitting.
I definitely think that's true. That's definitely a factor. Before I elaborate, I do kind of want to specify that, you know, a lot of times when I talk about specific approaches to things, people think I'm presenting some kind of either or polarity, and I'm absolutely not. So, you know, if I'm talking about things that are short, I'm not saying that those things can't be engaging, and I'm not saying that I hate new stuff and blah, blah, blah. But as far as what you're saying, there's definitely some games that if you put them down, you don't pick them back up. Everyone's had that experience where it's like, it's cool, I liked it and all, but I didn't play for a few days and I didn't want to go back. And then everybody has similar games that you can't put them down. And it's the same way with books. There are some books that when you put them down, they're difficult to return to because you're coming at it from a different place of experience, and simply because, you know, maybe you had something in life distract you, and you're not coming to as you said, you're not coming to the medium with the same, you know, set of experiences. But then again, there's also been books that you can't put down. So I definitely think that a lot of that becomes contingent on the work, whether that's a game or a book. I'm more, instead of saying, well, players aren't finishing a lot of video games, so we just have to make them shorter, I'm more interested in saying what is the difference between a game that you plow through because you can't stop and a game that, you know, feels too long. You know what I mean? I don't think that length in and of itself, or depth or density in and of itself, needs to be an inherent negative. Like, there are some games that I have not been able, they're 80-hour games, and I get through 10 hours and I'm like, God, I can't do this anymore. But like Persona, I like happily put in like 120 hours into Persona 4. Wow. Like, and I played every night. Like, there was a lot of times that I would rather have done that than like have a life. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, and I know that a lot of that comes down to my personal taste. You know, I finished like Metal Gear very quickly, and Fallout I'm still playing because, you know, I can only take it like once a week. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm more interested in sort of breaking out, you know, what makes a game that you can't put down different from a game that you don't come back to.
Well, can we like drill just a little bit deeper, turn the screw, so to speak? What do you think is inside games that make you come back to them or like never put them down? Is there something specifically in a specific game that you've played recently or over the last year or so that, you know, you felt this compulsion to play it? Can you put your finger on it?
If I could identify that as a single objective truth, I would be making about $1 million as a consultant right about now. I know that for me personally, I find myself becoming immersed and interested in games where I feel like I have some kind of involvement in what happens to the characters. Like, I can't put Metal Gear down because I'm a long time serious fan and I have like an inappropriate amount of affection for Snake. You know what I mean? So I think that what drove me through Metal Gear 4 when so many other people I know couldn't get through it was because I was really, really interested in seeing what happened in the story and really, really interested in seeing what happened to the characters. And then Persona gives you such a degree of Persona 4 and 3 give you such a degree of control over your protagonist and such a degree of control over your protagonist's involvement in the lives of other characters that you sort of, I'm attracted to characters and the stories of characters. That's what keeps me coming back. I know a lot of people who don't give a crap about that, you know, so I think it just has to be whatever floats your boat and whatever motivates you. Sometimes I get hooked by game mechanics. Like, I play Lumines every day and it doesn't have a story, you know what I mean? So I guess it probably has a lot to do with people's individual tastes and you know what keeps them wanting to come back.
I wonder how much of it is this is Sean, by the way. I read your Twit stream or Interscape microblog, whatever that is, and so clearly you're a fan of what the kids call the alternative or underground or hip music, right? Like,
are you calling me a hipster?
No. I mean, okay, well, A little bit, but in a good way. I mean, I'm guilty of it too, you know. So, but I mean, as just sort of a fellow person who likes, you know, not the mainstream thing, how does that fit in with sort of what's going on in video games now? I mean, I read your post on Gamma Sutra today about sort of a second month of losses in the video game industry and that being blamed on the fact that it's not Grand Theft Auto 4 and Mario Kart Wii, and I'm just wondering.
Issue. Yeah, what you're talking about on Gamma Sutra was people saying that when they every month when the NPD comes out, they're basically comparing this month to the same month last year to measure whether the industry is financially growing or not. And we're going to be seeing probably for March and April and possibly June, although they think it's going to get better in June, low declines, because this month last year those two games came out, so obviously we're not going to see the same kind of like sales numbers at game retail as we did last year. So that, I think, is a slightly different issue. But speaking about outside of mainstream stuff, it's funny, I actually very much like being a mainstream gamer. Like, I mean, not mainstream like Gears and Halo. That's just that those are awesome games. They're not my taste. But I have never, like, I've always felt like I should be more, and granted, I'm very into the indie scene, but I feel, you know, that I should be more than I am. I mean, what has attracted me to video games, because video games are already, even still, already in and of themselves not mainstream. So in getting into the latest hot game, I feel like I'm part of something small. You know what I mean? So when we have a major title that everyone on the internet is looking forward to, that's still not something that I'm going to be translating, like, normatively into, you know, like, regular people life. Like, you know what I mean? They're not going to understand. So I almost like to be part of the larger experiences. I like to share in the experience of checking out the major releases with everybody, because I think that there's a simultaneous sort of cultural process of sharing that we're all doing.
Nice. Well, if I can just sort of draw another connection there too that I'm wondering about, is like the reason why I was mentioning the MPD numbers was just because it seems to me that there really is, I agree with you about, you know, the fact that if you game at all, you're somewhat in a small group. But at the same time, I think I've definitely seen just in my gaming life, a lot more of a mainstreaming of games, and, you know, the rise of the casual market and everything has been huge. I wonder how much, like, sort of, you know, with music, it was like mainstream music sort of became the massive dominant form. And there was sort of, even when alternative music eventually became, like, amalgamated into that dominant form.
And then we sort of, so exciting because it was new, and then like we went from being like, oh my god, look at Kurt Cobain, and now it's like, oh wait, are you Nickelback? Like what? Like that's what Crunch turned into.
But I still have my flannel in the closet, Lee. What are you saying? I still have it.
I'm wearing it right
what
now.
What are we gonna do with this stuff?
But you know, all right. The online the network sort of, I mean, you know, sort of like the web, like, changed music though significantly, right? I mean, now a lot of people are listening to a lot of bands that I've never heard of, and it's a great thing. I mean, I just find out about more and more new stuff all the time.
Concert, you can just, like, link it to people all over Twitter like I do. You know what I mean? Like, I'm mostly trying to pimp local bands.
And I'm just wondering sort of what your take is on, like, how much you think the game industry is either sort of poised to do that with things like, you know, the iPhone App Store and stuff like that, or if that's even at all related to what's happening in other media.
No, I definitely think that there is a mainstreaming. I mean, even within our niche before, I mean, as with music, what's really happening to games is, I think, a couple of things. I think the recession is helping the mainstreaming of games, because other entertainment media are looking to us to how to make money now, us being the video game business. Not that I, you know, am a video game employee, but you know what I mean? So a lot of other entertainment media are looking to games right now because they're actually making money when other entertainment is not, loosely. What did it for music and what's doing it for us is the rise of digital platforms. You know, the web makes it a lot easier for people who don't own video game consoles to get into games. You know, the PC is the gaming platform with the widest install base, not the Wii. You know, that's it, or so the story goes. And also, yeah, the iPhone. I think that definitely because of digital distribution, games are becoming part of the same culture that embraces digitally distributed music. So I think that we're seeing a mainstreaming. I don't know yet how that's going to affect what you or I traditionally think of as like, when I say mainstream video game, I think of, like, you know, Halo. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But you know, maybe a mainstream video game is Peggle. You know what I mean? It just depends really on how you define mainstream versus the core market mainstream. You know what I mean? I'm definitely seeing several different definitions of that. I mean, there is a mainstreaming, but with that is definitely coming a stratification as well. We have a very strong independent scene that we didn't even have 5 years ago, that people weren't playing these flash developed browser based indies. They weren't downloading stuff that students made on their iPhone, you know, and you know, people like Cactus and Phil Fish and like Petri are like celebs now. Like, those are our indie superstars, and we didn't even have a scene like that. At least, I mean, I'm sure, I mean, obviously we've had a homebrew scene, an indie dev scene forever, but as far as us as an audience being aware of that is fairly new, I think, and the internet is really enabling that the same way it's done for music.
Nice.
Yeah, I think so.
With the digital platforming, I think it's inevitable we have to discuss what the future of coverage of games looks like. And of course, you're someone who's on the edge of that anyway, you know, with doing online conversation spaces. But there's, you know, been a lot of hand-wringing over the last year about, you know, the death of print journalism and how it's impacting the coverage of games. But, you know, now that we're starting to see newspapers folding up, I'm wondering, you know, this is kind of the stock question we have to ask to get into the deeper conversation, but I'm wondering what you sort of see the future of games journalism being now that it is very clearly moved onto a digital platform.
Man, like, that's even hard for me to speak to because I always had the ambition to be a conventional journalist. I wanted, you know, I wanted to be in print, you know, and I wanted to be on MTV. You know what I mean? Like, I really wanted, you know, coming from the outside, as far, you know, I wasn't really an internet forum person. Like, I read articles, but I wasn't really part of the internet world as it revolves around games until I started becoming a writer. But I always had the aspiration to be what you would consider a traditional journalist, you know, because from far away that looked like the thing to do and the way to make money and the glamorous way to be successful. But I came out of the internet. Sexy Video Game Land was one of the first things I did, and you know, I've done many clips in print and I've done many things for what you could call conventional outlets. But I know at least I can really only speak for myself, and I feel that the fact that I came out of a blog and I came out with a community behind me is a strength for me going into the future. I feel like people with really traditional ways of approaching journalism in general are going to be wildly, wildly limited, both in terms of how they understand their audience and the kind of reach they're going to be able to have. And that's not just true for video games journalism, but may be a little more true for video games journalism because game fandom is so closely tied to internet culture to a stronger degree than other things that people could possibly be writing about. So as far as, you know, and then that being said, I also think that we are kind of losing something. I didn't go to journalism school. I went to acting school. And a lot of the people whose blogs that you're reading and who are forming the spine of the discussion are not necessarily pro writers, and they you know, may be very good writers, obviously, but you know, we may be losing something in terms of incisiveness, in terms of quality, in terms of purpose, in terms of, you know, having a reason to write about a culture that is not just personal. You know, I wrote about this recently. You know, the sort of the rise of citizen journalism to me parallels the rise of multiplayer gaming. I don't want my friends to do it. You know, like, if I wanted to hear my friends' stories, I would hang out with my friends. I like a designer-driven environment, and I also like a conversation that's led by professional writers, you know, which, you know, I'm sort of maybe someplace in between being, you know, just by virtue of experience, I'm somewhere between being, you know, a leader type journalist and being a community member. I think maybe a happy medium is the way to go. But I really don't discount either approach. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, I do. I do. I wonder too, like, who gets to place the crown on the head of the one who, you know, speaks about games, and who gets the sanction? Because what you're just talking about of coming out of a community, having that sort of riding that wave and having people who are following you but also engaging with you seems really, really important. And I think this is one of the nuances of this new emerging games criticism is, there's actual discussion space that happens, you know, underneath the individual piece in the clip. Because one of the, you know, really one of the most wonderful things about Sexy Video Game Land is the initial post. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. The initial post is just an entry into, okay, let's talk about this. Here's what I think, and tell me how I'm wrong, please.
Exactly. Like, as a writer, one of my weaknesses, and this is something I've been working on, I think, in my Kotaku columns, is having a strong thesis. What motivated me to write, aside from the desire to have a career in writing, was not so much that I had something to say. I mean, there was part of it that, you know, I started writing The Aberrant Gamer because there were topics I didn't see a lot of people treating. But what continues to motivate me now is not so much having something to say, but having something to ask. It amazes me constantly the way people respond to the work that I do, and they start their own blogs off of something that I've written, and they send me their thoughts in email. Like, you know, I feel like, you know, people sometimes tell me that they think that I'm a leader or something, and I don't really, I'm ambivalent about my own work, but if I am able to in any way motivate that, I feel successful and I feel grateful to people. That's why, you know, anyone can call me up, I'll be on a podcast. Anyone writes me an email, I'll write back, because I feel like I'm part of the community. And if I have any kind of leadership, it's because people, you know, are responding somehow to something I'm doing and not because I inherently stand alone. You know what I mean? And I think that that's important, I think, for anyone who wants to write about entertainment, because it's a cultural experience. It's not about one person's interpretation. I haven't written a review in a while because I don't even feel all that comfortable saying this is a good game or this isn't a good game. I when I play a game, I'm not interested in telling people what I think. I want to know what they think. And I think that kind of cultural discussion is important, important in any entertainment media. And that's something that I really believe in a lot.
And that kind of attitude was not really something that, as a traditional journalist covering any field, you know, you would have had the option of taking a decade ago. So in what ways do you think that openness to the discussion starts to change the content, you know?
Well, again, I notice that I used the word my weakness as a writer, in that I often have more to ask than I have to say. I'm really working on developing having more to say. A lot of my posts are really open-ended, and I'm not so much making a statement so much as expressing an opinion that I'm hoping that people will add to. But, you know, in terms of a writer who's really going to, you know, because I do believe that a press, any media's press, medium's press can shape the way that it develops. And that's something that's important to me to have a role in. But in order to do that, I have to be able to speak a little more strongly around singular theses. That's been something I've been, you know, trying to do more of lately, because, you know, while I think that the community driven discussion is absolutely essential to culture and something that I think is one of the strengths of whatever coverage games receive on the web, I also think that if, you know, I am motivated a lot by the desire to see games advance and broaden and be taken more seriously and be treated with more sophistication. And so taking stances on that is something that I think it's important for me and other people like me to do a little bit more of, rather than rehashing the same old things, because it drives comments. So again, there's a downfall in the community driven model as well, because then we're just talking amongst ourselves and we're not able to reach anyone who doesn't, you know, because I'm talking to people who already care, you know what I mean? And I want to better be able to articulate to people who don't know us why they should care about us and why they should want to be part of our party.
Why do you think someone who isn't into games should be part of the party or should be welcomed into it? Why should they care about video games?
Well, because we need them. I need to come up with a compelling argument for them, because I don't think that the insularity of the game audience is healthy or helpful. That's something that I felt strongly about for a long time. Because obviously, if the only people who are talking about it are the people who already have an interest, we're not having new perspectives coming to the table. Like, how many people can you talk about with how awesome ICO is? You know what I mean? Like, we know, you know, like, let's have a new idea. Like, and another thing that concerns me, and again, we're making a parallel between community driven writing and discussion and multiplayer gaming. MMOs are being designed around the needs of a very specific user base and being designed in response to them, which is good, but that means it'll only ever serve this vocal minority. And that's not healthy to the creative growth of anything. Like, I'm not a big fan of MMOs. Like, I don't knock them or anything. I think that they're impeccable. Like, I think that Warcraft is like a piece of genius design, and I can understand why people like it. But again, I think that it's important for us to think about building a culture and creating products that are appealing, that can be appealing to the rest of the world. And for that, I think it's important to be able to sort of elevate the discussion beyond our community and be able to speak directly to people who are not part of our niche.
On what level, maybe, do you think that some of the resistance to games as an artistic medium might be coming out of these old attitudes of very strict authorial control in all artistic endeavors, you know, where the user, the reader, the viewer is not actively involved in shaping the narrative or shaping the understanding of the characterization, like you were talking about at the beginning of the show?
You know, I think that remains to be seen. I know that, you know, human beings in general are attracted to strong narratives. I still, and I may be wrong, I could be kicking myself in 10 years, am personally of the belief that people want to hear stories more than they want to write them. You know, that's why we watch TV series, and that's why we go to films. And there have been experiments in user-driven television that don't really take off, and it could be because we haven't done it right. You know, I'm not, like I said, I'm not I see the inherent strengths of the user-driven model, but more interesting to me is how do we tell stories better and more compellingly. I'm a fan of the author. I believe in the author. I think that some of the people who have made the greatest cultural contributions to humanity over the years are artists and authors who had a strong vision that they were able to articulate, whether that's through a painting or a piece of music or something. You know, I buy music because I like to listen to it. I don't want to go to the concert and be handed the instruments, you know? So, you know, and again, I'm finding myself straying into a one or the other kind of polarized thing. And I definitely think that there's room for both approaches and that both approaches are going to drive gaming in different and equally valid ways. I have a personal preference for the author. That's why I'm such a big Kojima fan, because I feel like he's one of the strongest authorial voices that we have.
You know, the four of us talking here have all had both experiences and then training as sentence and paragraph artists. And Lee, over the last like 3 or 4 days, is sort of, you know, getting really, really excited to get the chance to talk to you, was thinking about what do you think sort of, you know, artists of our stripe, if we want to call ourselves artists, because we have this kind of, you know, low-tech training of, you know, using sentences and paragraphs to construct things. What do you think that we bring to something like a medium like games, especially video games that are sort of multimodal in almost every way? What do we do, or what do writers do who are working with sort of lower technology? What can they bring to the table? What's their piece of it?
By low tech, do you mean words?
Yeah.
I think that the human language is the most sophisticated thing that civilization's ever invented. I think that the ability to communicate in words artfully is one of the most amazing things about human beings, that that human beings have evolved with so many different languages and can communicate with each other verbally and in text so many different ways. I wouldn't call it low technology at all. In fact, I think it's a gift that we have. And, you know, I have always thought of myself that way, as well as someone who, maybe if I was born with any kind of special ability, it's the ability to use words and to communicate. And, you know, I'm not making any kind of assertions as to how awesome I am at that or not. I just know that it's something that I consider a strength. And I think that people like us are important to games, because in order to be able to take lessons from our experience of entertainment, we have to be able to articulate it. Mm-hmm. And what we're articulating is very subjective emotional experiences. It takes a writer to be able to explain why a moment in a game is meaningful. Otherwise, the best we've got is, "That was so cool." You know what I mean?
Yep.
Or, you know, like, "I bought that," you know, and all marketing has is their sales data, you know, whereas if we are able to bring language and articulacy to the discussion, I think that's what we have to add.
I'm really overjoyed by your answer, because that's exactly what I wanted to hear. Is that we're able to, you know, for me personally, I'm really tired of having that kind of hand clapping moment be just the end of the experience. Like, "Oh yeah, that was good. Where's the next one?" We need to articulate, you know, thoughtful responses. And that's why I've always appreciated the work that you do, because it seems that that's exactly what you're after as well, is starting mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, no, you may know that one of the first things that I did pretty visibly on the internet was that Aberrant Gamer column at Gameset Watch. Mm-hmm. And I expressly chose to talk about aspects of games that we weren't discussing online or in verb or in words, because they're difficult to talk about. I mean, it's hard to talk about how you feel about the ending of Silent Hill 2. It's hard to talk about, you know, how you feel about a little sister choice. It's hard to talk about how you feel about sex games on the internet. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so it was important for me to go and try to tackle and articulate things that were a little bit dark and a little bit difficult. That's something I still actually am pretty drawn to.
You know, it's interesting, because you mentioned sort of about the innate human desire to, you know, hear narratives, engage with stories, tell stories. I'm thinking that probably there's a similar correlation with games, and I'm especially struck by, like, you know, you see sort of Ashton Kutcher and CNN Breaking News competing for, you know, 1 million followers on Twitter, or you have just everybody's circle of friends competing for however many friends on, you know, Facebook and stuff like that. I mean, how do you see Yeah, exactly. How do you see sort of like games permeating all of those other areas of our lives? And more, I guess more interestingly, sort of why do we bring these games everywhere to every technology, to every social situation? I mean, what is it?
Well, wait, Lee, before you answer that question, I have breaking news. And Major Nelson has tweeted some codes. So everybody needs to drop what they're doing and put in the code so they can get the Fallout DLC is coming out.
It's too late. No, but in the time it took you to tell me that, somebody already got them.
Oh, fuck.
I know, exactly. See, that's the thing. That is my problem, too.
Yeah. So you were talking about gaming and social networking, and I am not at all in a position to speak negatively of social networking in any way, because I have groused and bitched and complained about how much I hate Twitter, and I hate being nobody needs to know what I'm doing all the time, and why do I have to have all these Facebook friends who are not my friends? I don't remotely, not everybody who's on my Facebook list is my friend, and I couldn't give a rat's ass what they're doing with their lives, and yet I do it, and I do it like more compulsively than anyone I know. I have my iPhone and I go out and I'm like at concerts with my friends and I'm freaking checking my Twitter. Like, I to some extent cannot even explain it. I mean, I think the draw is that technology is making us able to feel part of a social fabric in a much more constant way. There's instantaneous feedback when you say something. There's instantaneous, gratification. There's the illusion that people care about you. You know what I mean? Because they mm-hmm. tweet back to you. By the way, I'm at Lee Alexander on Twitter. Please follow me.
You just got like... No, you got no new followers because everybody who's listening to this already is following me.
Hi, guys. Thank you for putting up with my Twitter. I'm trying to beat Kieran Gillen and have more followers than him.
It's a worthy goal.
Right. But you were asking how games fit into that. Well, there's actually there's a business and economy reason why people are trying to do that. Last year, I was, in addition to contributing on Gamma Sutra, I ran its little sister site, worldsinmotion.biz, which was entirely devoted to the emerging, when it was still considered emerging, social virtual world space and Web 2.0 space. So I did learn a fair bit about sort of some of the thinking behind these new platforms as why everybody wants to use them for games. It's because things like Twitter and Facebook are able to do things that games online games by themselves have failed to do, and that is engage players. There are specific user. I mean, the user base of something like a MySpace or a Facebook, blows even our best MMOs out of the water. So it's that the audience is there, that there is this completely engaged and willing audience who actively wants to be on these sites, even though there's nothing to do there. And so let's give them something else to do. You know what I mean? It's more of the pragmatic economics of being able to tap such a huge, modern, connected user base of people who obviously, and if you're using the Facebook platform to deliver games, you don't have to worry about whether people can play your games or not. They're there. They can obviously already use the platform. It's free. So there's a lot of potential there for developers to leverage and reach new audiences. I think that's the the major part of the drive in getting games on social networks, because people will become engaged with social games on Facebook with the same sort of addicted tendency with which they tag their friends' photos and do all those things that I do constantly on Facebook. There's this one game called Pet Society on Facebook, and it's the only time I've ever microtransacted. Until iTunes, I didn't pay for anything online, and even when I was already buying music regularly, I said, I'll just play. I didn't want to play a game where I would have to pay for content. I was as opposed to that as anybody. But now I sort of have capitulated to the inevitability of that. Like, I have spent freaking $60 on Pet Society. I'm not even kidding. On a Facebook game, and it's like all it is like a little cat in a house that I buy clothes for. I do not understand. Like, it has gotten me to fucking sell out to this kind of thing, and I don't even know why I'm doing it. Okay, do you know what a gold mine that is to a game developer? We can get people like Lee Alexander to spend money right out of her PayPal, and she doesn't even know why she's doing it. I mean, so there's a lot of fiscal opportunity, and there's a lot of opportunity in terms of reach and audience, and people are still, I think, there was a major gold rush to gaming on social networks that I'm sure is going to ebb away a little bit when people realize that, like, you know, how many of those gaming and app invitations do you get on your social network? Like, it's a constant barrage to the point where, you know, so-and-so has done this with you and wants you to play this with them, and can you beat his high score? And then, like, you start, because there is a lot of audience desensitization to that, and I think that that's going to start, you know, taking some of the air out of that bubble pretty fast.
Yeah, yeah. When Engai Kroll is twittering, like, he has an auto-connect with
his word foo.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Oh my God. You get somebody like that, then you're obviously onto something.
Right, right, yeah. Right, exactly. And then, like, you know, I haven't done it yet, but seeing Engai constantly playing word foo, you know, I mean, Engai is a friend of mine and someone I respect enormously and have learned a ton from. And I'm always, you know, we're totally cool. I'm always happy to see him. But we're also a little bit competitive and we butt heads sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I see him playing the word foo. I'm like, I'm going to go try and beat him at this. You know what I mean? So, like, I haven't actually done it yet, but the temptation is there. So in this case,
I did that, you know, and I just want to put it out here right now that he got 1,800. I trounced him with 6,000, not a tweet back at all, you know. No answer whatsoever.
Well, you know, and Guy's also a Lakers fan, so you can expect that from him.
But I'm sorry to interrupt you, Lee. I just...
No, do. We're having a fluid community. but in that case, and also I should say that Engai is the one who got me into Twitter as well. I used to think he was ridiculous doing Twitter, but I told him this moment when I saw him at GDC, we were talking about this. So you know that all the publishers do their financial calls and their conference calls when they announce their results, and that's when we listen for the really juicy executive quotes about, you know, Stras Zelnick talking about EA or Bobby Kotick talking about DJ Hero, or, you know, so you have to kind of listen. So I'm sitting on Gamasutra and I'm covering the conference call. I publish the numbers first and then I listen to the call and do a follow-up story on any relevant comments that were made. So I'm sitting there listening and I'm writing and I am in the back end of Gamasutra preparing this article. And I'm looking at Twitter, and Engai is tweeting, all the good quotes already. Like, I'm sitting here making an article. He's already reached 8,000 people with that same bit of information before I've even hit publish. You know, mm-hmm. And even though, obviously, Twitter is not necessarily journalism, I was like, well, there's something to that he was already just hanging out at his computer, able to reach all of these people and communicate the information. And I'm sitting here writing an article like a last-gen stooge. You know what I mean? So it was really that sort of mentality of being able to instantaneously communicate that sort of drew me to Twitter. And I it's been hard for me since being on Twitter to keep up with my blogging, because a lot of what's motivated me on Sexy Video Game Land is the sense of being connected with you guys and with the community. And now I have that immediately on Twitter. Now, I don't necessarily believe that immediacy, the shallowness and immediacy, is a good thing. You know, I like time spent. I like depth. And I worry that we're being trained the wrong way. You know, like I said in my most recent post, the one that you opened the discussion with, I am worried that this tendency towards the bite-sized chunks is making us into passive individuals who only operate on instant gratification, as opposed to, you know, getting the kind of gratification that is the payoff after a lot of work. So, again, we're making parallels between writing and games, but... I'm halfway through my gin now, so I'm straying off topic a little bit. I apologize.
I wonder too, as we talked about writing earlier, these sites like Facebook and Twitter that are so heavily text based. I wonder. I know anyway. Personally, I find myself that participating in these spaces has made me, on some level, view. My life is a game space, right? Because I'm constantly thinking oh, is this worth writing on Twitter about?
And it's absolutely worse for me, because to an extent it's my job to have a virtual presence in the game space. So it's this all does definitely start to feel as extensible. And I think that now we come back to what you're talking about before, is how this sort of online culture has a relationship to games, how these sort of social networks and new tech and blogs and whatever are becoming extensions of what we're doing on our consoles in our living room.
That's also probably why I'm so suspicious of this sort of corporate community management. Every console maker and every game publisher has.
They've got marketing people on that like dogs on a bone right now. They are going to find out how they can use you.
Yeah.
And that's just business. It's not because they're bad people.
No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I wonder, video games seem to have arrived full force when, at least for me personally, when Grand Theft Auto 4 comes out and they have all the sales figures around that. And it's like, look at what a vibrant and money-making medium this is. And so let's kind of put some of those other kinds of questions aside. But what I'm hoping is happening, and certainly with writers like yourself, is we're finally moving away slowly but surely from the emphasis on those numbers and into something more meaningful. Is that something that you I know that that's something you're working towards. Is that something that you think you're getting some traction with now?
I don't know. You said you used the word arrived. I would say that we've got the car. You know what I mean? We haven't arrived yet, but we have a car now. It is still striking to me, the disconnect. Now, you're right. We have this very strong and vibrant arc happening, and it's being assisted by all of these internet platforms that are allowing us to be social and allowing us to get rid of some of our insularity. But at the same time, I am still you and I and this community that feels so huge to us because of the internet is really very small. I did a feature on Kotaku about this. How if you go to GameStop, they don't even know what Kotaku is. You know what I mean?
That's like, not surprising.
No, like they don't know, like, you know, like they don't, you know, like I feel like every quote unquote everybody reads my articles because I get so much mail and I have some, you know, I have all the people talking to me on Twitter and people want me to be on their podcast. But like, you know, if I go out into the real world, you know, nobody knows who the H I am and nobody knows what I'm talking about on what we, you know, even though like 1 week there could be a topic that is like the talk of the town for us. The world does not know about it. We are still, you know, we are gaining reach. We don't have it yet. Like if you try to talk to someone who's not like from our world, who doesn't use the internet the way we do and who doesn't play games, it's completely foreign to them and not relevant to them yet. You know, so I feel like there's still a huge disconnect. In fact, I sort of worry about the danger in this internet-enabled social networking sort of reinforcing our sense of size before we actually have attained it. Mm-hmm. We have power in our own community. We don't have power in the world yet. I mean, we're getting there. It's the numbers though that are getting us there. It's the economy and the sales figures that are making that happen right now. I mean, hopefully we'll bridge that gap, but you know, I would not use the word arrived just yet. We are arriving. Mm-hmm. And I think that we will arrive.
All right, so that should wrap it up for this episode of the show. We want to make sure and thank Lee Alexander from Gamasutra and Kotaku, as well as Sexy Video Game Land, for taking the time to have this great conversation with us today. So thanks so much again, Lee, and we really appreciate it and enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciated the opportunity.
Always, always. But yeah, so you know, until next time, make sure to stop by firstwallrebate.com. And I'm Shane Hinton.
I'm Trevor Dodge.
And I'm Sean Ryder.
Thanks for listening.
So let me know when it's up. I'll put a link up on the blog.